VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Lebanon's health ministry said Sunday Israeli airstrikes have killed dozens of people in Lebanon south, as Hezbollah also confirmed the death of another high-ranking official. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Shortly after the consecutive strikes on Ain al-Dalb, east of Sidon, rescuers came with excavators to search through the rubble. Separately, Lebanon's health ministry said Israeli strikes in the northern province of Baalbek Hermel killed at least 20 people and injured dozens more. Meanwhile, Israel's military has said dozens of Israeli aircraft have struck Houthi targets in Yemen. Fire and plumes of smoke could be seen in the air over Hodeidah after the strikes. The strikes in Yemen and Lebanon came as Hezbollah confirmed the death of Nabih Kaouk, the seventh senior Hezbollah leader slain in Israeli strikes in little over a week. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the appointment of a former rival, Gideon Saar, as a member of his cabinet, expanding his coalition and strengthening his hold on office. I'm Karen Chamas.
U.S. President Joe Biden said Sunday he would speak with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and believes an all-out war in the Middle East must be avoided.
It has to be. We really have to avoid it. We've already taken precautions relative to our embassies and personnel who want to leave. Not there yet, but we're working like hell with the French and many others.
The Iran-backed Hezbollah has sustained a string of deadly blows to its command structure, including the killing of its overall leader, Hassan Nasrallah, as part of a wave of increasingly brazen Israeli strikes meant to undercut the group's capacity to attack its territory. This is VOA News. Officials said Sunday the death toll from Hurricane Helene is at least 84, with dozens of deaths in the U.S. state of North Carolina as rescue efforts continue. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper says the state is hard at work getting food and water to hundreds of thousands of people trapped by Hurricane Helene in the mountains, even as rescue efforts continue.
A lot of people who are concerned about relatives and friends that they cannot get in touch with.
He says they are trying to get cell phone communications up.
We know that a lot of these people are just simply out of communication and are okay.
Nearly 300 roads remain closed. At least 45 out-of-state search and rescue teams joined 500 National Guard troops in both rescues and airdropping food and water. I'm Julie Walker.
The United Arab Emirates said early Monday the residence of its ambassador in Khartoum was attacked by a Sudanese military aircraft, condemning it as a quote-unquote heinous attack. The Sudanese army has repeatedly accused the UAE of providing weapons and support to the paramilitary rapid support forces in Sudan's 17-month-old war. Both the U.S. Republican and Democratic vice presidential nominees have been preparing for their debate that will be hosted by CBS News Tuesday in New York. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias reports.
Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance recently shared what his primary message to voters will be when he debates Democratic rival Tim Walz on Tuesday.
The team that actually has a plan is the team of Trump-Vance.
Republican Representative Tom Emmer has been helping the Ohio senator prepare. Emmer appeared Sunday on ABC's This Week show.
Tim Walz is just going to try and deflect and go into this folksy whatever. He'll hold him accountable.
The Minnesota governor has also been reportedly sharpening his debate skills. Reproductive rights will probably be one of Walz's strongest lines of attack against Vance, says John Mark Hansen, political science professor at the University of Chicago. He spoke with VOA via Skype.
Vance may be pressed on whether, as President Trump would sign an abortion ban.
Voters who tune in Tuesday could get a sense of whether the vice presidential nominees provide them with a sense of comfort. But unless there is some kind of meltdown, Hansen says it is not likely the debate will move the presidential race's needle. Veronica Valderas-Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Hamas leader, Hassan Nasrallah, has been killed in an Israeli attack.
I think that what we see right now is a very significant moment in the story of the Middle East, witnessing these first stages of a significant, I would say, geostrategic shift.
Another far-right win in Europe. As the Freedom Party won the parliamentary election in Austria, and Super Mario, Zelda, Game Boy, and Switch, they're all in the new Nintendo Museum.
I heard that people had to wait for 2 months to get a ticket.
Today is Monday, September 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Israel unleashed a series of overnight attacks in Lebanon, and it announced the killing of another high-level Hezbollah commander. The strikes aim to further rattle Hezbollah after airstrikes killed the group's chief, Hassan Nasrallah. Here's VOA's Arash Arabasadi with the story.
Smoke still rises Sunday from what's left of high-rise apartments after an Israeli strike in the suburbs of Beirut on Friday. The Israeli military says it was targeting the leader of the U.S.-designated terror group Hezbollah. The group on Saturday confirmed the death of its leader, Hassan Nasrallah. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu labeled Nasrallah as someone set on destroying Israel.
Nasrallah was not another terrorist. He was the terrorist. He was the axis of the axis, the central engine of Iran's axis of evil. He and his people were the architects of the plan to destroy Israel.
Meanwhile, Hezbollah's biggest backer, Iran, raised a black flag atop the Imam Reza shrine following Nasrallah's death. The sign of mourning came as Hezbollah issued a statement saying Nasrallah joined his fellow martyrs, while vowing to, quote, continue holy war against the enemy and in support of Palestine. As hundreds of families now sleep in the Beirut streets, joining what the Lebanese government says are 1 million displaced people, the Israel Defense Forces released a series of videos claiming to show strikes against dozens of Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. Israel says it warned civilians to get out of the way. But the country's leader blasted Israel's offensive.
Unfortunately, the law of the jungle that controls the world has made the Israeli enemy stall all efforts for a ceasefire and continue its war against Lebanon because it does not care about the law or international legitimacy.
Overnight attacks this weekend continued in Beirut, prompting concern for what may follow. Meanwhile, hundreds of demonstrators in Baghdad protested Nasrallah's killing and attempted to breach the fortified Green Zone in Iraq, home to the U.S. Embassy. Lebanon's health ministry reports more than 1,000 Lebanese dead and 6,000 wounded in the past 2 weeks. Lebanon began firing rockets into northern Israel after the October 7 Hamas terror attack on Israel triggered the ongoing conflict in Gaza. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
There are some who believe we're seeing a turning point in the Middle East conflict. Among them is Avi Melamed, an ex-Israeli intelligence official and current CEO of Inside the Middle East. He joins us now to talk about this. So thank you so much for being able to talk to us.
Of course.
So what do you think is happening right now? We're seeing a lot of activity between Israel and Hezbollah.
Well, I think that what we see right now is a very significant moment in the story of the Middle East. We are kind of like, I think, would say, witnessing these first stages of a significant, I would say, geostrategic shift, as Israel is seriously, significantly crushing the Hezbollah military capacities. This is, of course, a shift that will have very significant ramifications.
Do you think that this is what they've wanted for a long time? This was not a spur-of-the-moment response to
when you say
attack.
They, you mean
Israel. Well, I think everybody, Israel, Hezbollah, Hamas, Iran.
This is a process that has been brewing for a long period of time, in the sense that the Iranian threat and the Iranian proxies threat has been building up through the last couple of decades. And so in that sense, we are looking at a point in the story of the Middle East where Israel, that has been for many years dealing with this continuing exhaustion threat initiated by Iran and its proxies, Israel is now, may say that it's taking off the gloves. And Israel, as we can all see, is smashing right now Hezbollah, which is the most significant proxies of the Iranian. And obviously the ramifications is sending a huge, aftershock waves across the Middle East.
You know, for example, the elimination of Hassan Nasrallah, the Israeli military said that is a plan, the plan that they used to get him, has been around for more than 10 years. Like, they've been ready for this moment.
Well, definitely. Look, I can tell you, Israel has been building its for this exact moment in many perspectives. Obviously, one of the most important, significant perspectives is the intelligence gathering and building the intelligence capacities to be able to synchronize the all factors in the moment of truth, so to speak. And this is exactly what we see today. So that is correct. We are looking at an Israeli move that has been brewed carefully and very, thoroughly and thoughtfully brewed for a long period of time.
What's the objective on both sides, the Israeli side and the Iranian Hezbollah Hamas side?
Well, from Israel's perspective, the objective is very clear. Israel needs to remove this constant and increasing threat. We have to remember that for the last 40 years, I'm talking about four decades, the Iranians, through their proxies, mostly Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad, have been presenting a constant and increasing military threat to the state of Israel, reminding you the endless rounds of military exchange of fire, particularly following Hamas taking over Gaza Strip in 2007. And so we have been witnessing a process where Iran was enhancing almost undisturbedly, so to speak, process of like building its capacities, using its proxies while sitting safe and sound in Tehran, totally immune from any repercussion for the violence and instability the Iranian regime has scattered across, implanted across the Middle East. From the Hamas and Hezbollah, in Iranian perspective, of course, their purpose was to eliminate Israel and is to eliminate Israel. This is what they're saying.
There is no short end to this, is there?
Well, look, I mean, this moment, as I said in the beginning of our discussion and conversation, is very much is very much different. It's very significant because it is a very significant. It's not more of the same of what we witnessed in the last, I would say, roughly speaking, 20 or even 30 years. This is something totally different. This is the moment in time where Israel basically says, this story comes to an end, and we are not going to take any more of this constant erosion and constant threat that has been significantly increasing in the course of time. And we are determined to eliminate that threat at all costs. And so this is what we see today. And this is very significant, not only because of the fact that by doing that, Israel is totally changing the game rules, but not less significant because by doing that, Israel is changing dramatically the trajectory of the Middle East geostrategic landscape, which has been to a large extent subject in the last four decades to the Iranian master plan. We are now in a new chapter in the story of the Middle East, and we are still waiting, and the aftershock waves of what we see today are still yet to come. And I would add to that I can promise you that many in the Arab world shed no tears to see the Iranian proxies severely beaten down to the ground, because they have been presenting not less significant threat to the Arab nations across the Middle East, not less than to the Israel.
Well, Iran has attacked its neighbors just in the last 18 months.
Well, yes. I mean, Iran has been directly attacking Saudi Arabia. It has been attacking Saudi's oil infrastructure directly and indirectly using its proxies. Iranian proxies are attacking maritime in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. So in the end of the day, when you look at the whole situation, it's very clear that all strings lead to the mullah regime in Tehran. And right now what we see is that the mullah regime in Tehran, for the first time, I would say, in the last four decades, I would say that the mullah regime in Tehran now facing for the first time ever a serious challenge to its master plan, where its proxies are sustaining significant blows by Israel, and hence we could say today that the Iranian master plan of taking over the Middle East and the region through the use of its proxies, that master plan today has been to a large extent compromised and neutralized to a large extent.
When the dust settles, what do you think the Middle East looks like? Does this regime change in Iran, or are they just so crippled that they no longer become a regional threat?
Well, this regime is not going to change. This is to start with. The second thing is they are already crippled by the massive blow that their proxy sustained. It also crippled since absorbing those blows and actually not retaliating basically shows the Mullah regime as a tiger made of paper, which is very significant when you're talking about it in the context of the Middle East, because we are looking at what we call the image of deterrence. It's very clear today that the image of deterrence and the deterrence, per se, that the Mullah regime was building and fostering and nurturing for the last four decades, that image as well as deterrence capacity has been to a large extent compromised. In the Middle East terminology in dictionary, the meaning of that is one single thing: you are weak. And so today, obviously, the Mullah regime understands that because he speaks the language of the Middle East. He knows that. Further boost already existing sentiments of defiance across the Middle East towards the Mullah's regime imperialistic ambitions. Those sentiments exist in Lebanon and in Syria and in Iraq because they will gain a backwind. The other one, I would say, we will see a boosting of the process of Israel becoming a central, if not the central, axis of stability and hence viewed as an enormously valuable strategic partner by major Arab players. Israel today has been rehabilitating enormously its deterrence capacity. The Middle East is watching what happened to Hezbollah and what happened to Hamas and what is happening to Houthis. And when you speak the language of the Middle East, the people of the Middle East understand that language. So you got a situation that while the Iranian regime is now being viewed as a tiger made of paper, Israel is now viewed as a real tiger that you don't want to mess around with.
Huh. Thank you so much for the time and the perspective.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Avi Melamed, a former Israeli intelligence official and CEO of Inside the Middle East. Austria's far-right Freedom Party needs now to find a path to power after its historic parliamentary election victory left the anti-establishment outfit needing a partner to form a governing coalition. The triumph of the Eurosceptic Russia-friendly FPO on Sunday was another milestone in the recent rise of Europe's hard right. But the party immediately suffered a stiff reality check. facing FPO party leader Herbert Kickl in a television studio after results came in. Leaders of the other parties in parliament dismissed his overtures on forming a coalition. Here's Associated Press correspondent Karen Chalmers.
The far-right Freedom Party has been tapping into anxieties about immigration, inflation, Ukraine and other concerns following recent gains for the hard right elsewhere in Europe. Herbert Kickl, who has led the party since 2021, wants to become Austria's new chancellor. But to achieve that, he would need a coalition partner to command a majority in the lower house of parliament. I'm Karen Chalmers.
We're following these other stories from around the world. The United Arab Emirates said early on Monday the residence of its ambassador in Khartoum was attacked by a Sudanese military aircraft, condemning it as a heinous attack. California Governor Gavin Newsom on Sunday vetoed a hotly contested artificial intelligence safety bill after the tech industry raised objections, saying it could drive AI companies from the state and hinder innovation. South Korea's factory output in August beat market expectations and increased by the most in a year, according to government data on Monday. The industrial output index rose 4.1% over the month on a seasonally adjusted basis after a dip of 3.9% the previous month, according to Statistics Korea. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, both the U.S. Republican and Democratic vice presidential nominees are preparing for their debate that will be hosted by CBS News Tuesday in New York. VOA's Veronica Valdez Iglesias looks at the policies that J.D. Vance and Tim Walz might focus on and whether the debate itself could impact the outcome of the U.S. presidential race.
Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance recently shared what his primary message to voters will be when he debates Democratic rival Tim Walz on Tuesday.
That the candidacy, the team of substance, the team that actually has a record that we're proud of instead of we're running away from, and the team that actually has a plan is the team of Trump-Vance.
Republican Representative Tom Emmer has been helping the Ohio senator prepare for the 90-minute debate that will be hosted in New York by CBS News. Emmer appeared Sunday on ABC's This Week show.
He can talk about the economy that Donald Trump fixed and that Harris and Biden broke. He can talk about the border that Trump fixed and they broke. And once he understands that Tim Walz is just going to try and deflect and go into this folksy whatever, he'll hold him accountable.
The Minnesota governor has also been reportedly sharpening his debate skills. His messaging to voters often centers on how consequential the November 5th election is.
It's all on the line, not just for the next 4 years, but for the next 40 years.
Reproductive rights will probably be one of Walz's strongest lines of attack against Vance, says John Mark Hansen, political science professor at the University of Chicago. He spoke with VOA via Skype.
Vance may be pressed on whether, as president, Trump would sign an abortion ban or a very, very short period where abortions could be performed nationwide.
Voters shouldn't expect the VP nominees to provide a breakdown of their campaign's proposed policies, Hansen noted.
The debates are always more show than they are substance. The candidates have become very, very skilled at pivoting away from the question they were asked and instead addressing an issue that they want to address.
Voters who tune in Tuesday could get a sense of whether the vice presidential nominees provide them with a sense of comfort. But unless there is some kind of meltdown, Hansen says it is not likely the debate will move the presidential race's needle. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Republicans on Sunday sought to distance themselves from Donald Trump's latest insults of Democratic nominee Kamala Harris, made during a rambling weekend speech in Wisconsin.
Joe Biden became mentally impaired. Kamala was born that way.
Among Republican politicians pushing back on the comments is the governor of the U.S. state of Maryland, Larry Hogan, who's running for the U.S. Senate as a Republican. He made this comment on the CBS program Face the Nation on Sunday.
Well, I think all of that is outrageous and unacceptable, and I've already called him out when he had the one interview where he was questioning her racial identity, and now he's questioning her mental competence. And I think that's insulting not only to the vice president, but to people that actually do have mental disabilities.
Harris has not commented on Trump's recent attacks, but has said when asked about other comments that it was, quote, the same old show, the same tired playbook we've heard for years, with no plan on how he would address the needs of the American people. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. It could be the deadliest accident in 30 years of crossings from Africa to the Canary Islands. Hopes of finding any of the 48 migrants missing since their boat sank near the Spanish island of El Hierro are diminishing. The latest now from Reuters correspondent Diane Toe.
Patrol boats and helicopters continued a second day of search near the Spanish island of El Hierro after emergency services received a distress call from the boat in the early hours of Saturday. They said wind and poor visibility made the rescue extremely difficult and that the boat sank during the rescue attempt. Rescuers were able to pick up 27 of 84 migrants from the boat, but at least 9 people died in the incident, authorities said, including a child. Candelaria Delgado, who heads up the Canary Islands Regional Social Welfare Department, said minors who have arrived are at a temporary reception center. She urged the Spanish government to activate a mechanism with the European Union that would allow minors to be transferred to other parts of the continent, saying the island needed help tackling the humanitarian crisis. Data from the EU's border agency Frontex showed that the route from Africa to the islands has seen a surge in migrants this year, with more than 21,000 crossing in the first 7 months. 3 other boats reached the Canary Islands on Saturday night, carrying more than 200 migrants.
Reuters correspondent Diane Toe. At least 151 people have been killed in Nepal since early on Friday, as persistent downpours have triggered flooding and landslides, closing major roads and disrupting domestic air travel. The floods brought traffic and normal activity to a standstill in the Kathmandu Valley. Some parts of the capital reported rain up to 322 millimeters, pushing the level of its main river up 2.2 meters past the danger mark. And finally, Japanese gaming giant Nintendo will open a museum this week showcasing its history, where fans of Super Mario, The Legend of Zelda, of Game Boy and Switch can gain insight into one of the world's most renowned game makers. Here's Reuters correspondent Lauren Cook with the hack.
The museum, located in Japan's Uji, underscores its many evolutions, like the iconic Wii console and handheld Game Boy. Visitors will also see lesser-known products, such as the Mama Berica baby stroller and the Coppola's printer, in a push from Nintendo to expand beyond its core gaming business. The creator of Super Mario says the museum is intended to deepen understanding of the company, which was founded in 1889 as a maker of playing cards before becoming the global gaming giant that it's now known as. While game enthusiasts will likely try and secure tickets to the new museum, it might be harder than it looks.
If possible, I would like to go and visit the museum. But I heard that people had to wait for 2 months to get a ticket. I think it would be difficult to get in, even for locals.
But there's little doubt many will wait it out to see mustachioed plumber Mario in action.
Reuters correspondent Lauren Cook. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Wolterman.